Last summer, I was offered to serve as the rabbinic advisor to the students of the Shanstein Honors Program at Yeshiva College as they embarked on a 12-day visit to Japan. To stay in Japan was an unforgettable experience. It was a non-stop whirlwind of visits to art museums, Japanese financial institutions, a Japanese professional baseball game, sumo wrestling club, kabuki theater, beautiful gardens, and much more. I gave a daily shiur on the fourth parak of Brachos, and as an added leitmotif, I compared the Bavli and Yerushalmi's positions on various topics. We were in Japan the day of the yard site of Rabbi Gaon of Dovlecha Zatzal. That day, I dedicated my shiur to his memory. My duties entailed much more than those of a Magid Shiur, however. We had to deal with numerous halakhic issues that occurred during our stay. So I'd like to today present a brief synopsis of some of them. Probably the most pressing issue was the issue of Shabbos, which of course leads us to the issue of the international dateline and Shabbos in Japan. I have my audio visual aid here, the globe. Japan's territory consists of a series of islands, all located off the east coast of the Eurasian landmass. Tokyo's coordinates are approximately 35 degrees 40 minutes north latitude and 139 degrees 45 minutes east longitude east of Greenwich. Yerushalayim's coordinates, on the other hand, are 31 degrees 47 minutes north latitude and 35 degrees 13 minutes east of Greenwich longitude. And all that means is the following. Standard time in Tokyo and Kyoto, the two cities where we stayed, is 14 hours later than Eastern Standard Time, New York, 9 hours later than Greenwich, England, and 7 hours later than Standard Time in Yerushalayim. So according to Worldwide Convention, Japan is the Far East. If one travels to Japan from the United States going west, as we did, one would cross the international dateline and jump 24 hours. So what's the problem? The problem is, where is the halakhic international dateline? The fact that there is a line in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, which was set up by convention at the end of the 19th century, may not be relevant for halakha. Now, assuming for halakhic purposes, which all shittos do, that the center of the world for purposes of time calculations, Yerushalayim. So, Yehuda HaLevi in the Sefer Kuzari has a remarkable view. And his view is adopted by the Baal HaMor in his comments on Maseches Rosh Hashanah, Tav Chof Amud Beis. They both claim that the international dateline is a line 90 degrees east of Yerushalayim. So if we mentioned before, Yerushalayim is 35 degrees east of Greenwich, 35 plus 90, 125 degrees. That would basically take us to the east coast of China. Actually, even a little before that. So according to that, Japan is not the far east at all. It's the far west. So therefore, any area more than 90 degrees east of Yerushalayim, not the far east, is the far west. Therefore, everything should be a day back, right? So for example, let's say it's 12 o'clock in Yerushalayim, 12 noon. So it's, let's assume that Shabbos starts 6 o'clock. So it's 1 o'clock as you go further east, 2 p.m., 3 p.m., finally it's 6 p.m., but it's now 7 p.m. But if it's 12 noon Friday afternoon, is it 7 p.m. Friday night? That's the convention of the world. But if you hold that the dateline is only 6 hours east of Yerushalayim, it's 7 p.m. Thursday night. In other words, because it's not that Japan is 7 hours ahead of Yerushalayim, it's 17 hours west of Yerushalayim. This, of course, had a lot of ramifications during World War II when so many of the refugees from the Mir Yeshiva were in Kobe, Japan. Now, there was a big debate. We'll get to some of the issues in a minute. I will tell you that the Chazon Ish added the following stipulation. He tried to safeguard the position of the Khuzari and the Balamor in spite of the new discoveries of the new world. But in any event, he also claimed that it's not just 90 degrees, it's 90 degrees plus any land mass connected to a land mass which is less than 90 degrees. So for example, you look in the map, you see Australia. The western part of Australia is within 90 degrees east of Yerushalayim. So therefore, if it's 12 o'clock noon, Friday afternoon in Yerushalayim, so it will be 5 p.m., it's further east, so 5 hours later, in the western part of Australia, it will be 6 p.m., but there's no dateline running through landmass. So there's no dateline running through Australia. So the 7 p.m. part is going to be 7 hours, not 7 hours later than Yerushalayim. It won't be 7 p.m. Thursday, it will be 7 p.m. Friday. So this, however, does not help us for Japan. Why? Because Japan is a series of islands located off the Eurasian landmass. There's nothing connecting Japan to China or Kamchatka or the Far East. So therefore, Khazanish claimed that I don't care what the Japanese people do, their status is not relevant halakhically. The question is, what is correct of the halakha? He claimed that people should not fast on the day that Yom Kippur was supposed to be that year. Thank you. He claimed that you have to move everything a day. In other words, what everyone thought was Wednesday was really Tuesday, and therefore what everyone thinks is Thursday is really Wednesday, etc. Now, this of course caused a lot of issues, put it that way, in our trip. Because what are we going to do on Sunday? Right? In other words, we have a chiyuv to keep Shabbos, and we have a debate among different authorities as to which day is Shabbos in Japan. Now, first let me now present the following. Many Rishonim disputed the position of the Khuzari. So Rav Yitzchak Yisraeli, for example, the 14th century author of the Sefer Yesod Olam, he pointed out the following. By his time, the late medieval period, although they still did not discover America yet, they already had better maps of the Eastern Hemisphere. He pointed out that the Eurasian landmass extends 90 degrees beyond 24 degrees east of Yerushalayim. And that actually is correct. It's even a little more than that. In other words, if Yerushalayim is 35 degrees east, you have areas which are 149 degrees east. Now, according to the Khuzari, according to the Balam Or, Yesod Olam says something absurd will result. You draw your line 90 degrees east of Yerushalayim. So what will happen? You'll have two people sitting across the table. One is 90 degrees minus delta east of Yerushalayim. The other one is 90 degrees plus delta east of Yerushalayim. They're across a coffee table. One person is having coffee on this side, one person is having coffee on that side. For one person, it will be Thursday night. For the other person, it will be Friday night. It's insane, he claimed. It's claimed that you'll have two people that could have a conversation with each other separated by 24 hours. Therefore, what did he say? The Yesod Olam said the Khuzari is wrong because the only possible idea is that the international dateline in Yerushalayim should be 180 degrees. The other side of the globe, the absolute opposite of Yerushalayim. Both Yesod Olam and the Khuzari agree that the center of the world for halakhic time purposes is Yerushalayim. No one gives in on that. However, whereas Yehuda Halevi claims it should be 90 degrees east of Yerushalayim, the other people say it should be much further. The Yesod Olam has a very interesting line. He says that the international dateline should be Be'emtza Hayam, because he says, Lo echpas lohem l'dagi hayom, whether it's Shabbos, Motzai Shabbos. Put it in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Now, actually, Rav Tukachinsky used the Yisod Olam, and he pushed it further. He said that the halakhic international dateline indeed is a line 180 degrees east of Yerushalayim. Hence, Japan is still considered the Far East. Consequently, the minhag hamakom of the Japanese people regarding the day that they consider is Saturday, Shabbos, is correct in accordance with the halakhic reality. Now, question is, did the discovery of America have any implications for the halakhic process? So in the 1600s, there was a famous scientist, historian, Talmud of Maral named Rav David Ganz. He wrote a book called Nechmad Benayim. He is one of the first, if not the first, Jewish author to recognize the discovery of America, and he discusses some of the implications. One of the implications is the determination of the dateline. He points out the discovery of America and the concomitant fact that the land is full of people poses a great problem for the Shita of the Khazari in Balamor. Why? Because what's the Shita of the Balamor? They assume that the world only contains 180 degrees of inhabited land. The Balamor says that Beferish. He talks about the eastern part of the Atlantic Oceanus and the western part. They thought the entire western hemisphere was ocean. As I learned in ninth grade in MTA, being my science teacher, say it was Mr. Ehrenstein, he pointed out that all smart people in antiquity, Middle Ages, knew that the Earth was a sphere. What they did not know is that there is a landmass called the western hemisphere. That was not known. So, how did the Khuzari get to the 90 degrees east of Yerushalayim Shita? Well, you say Yerushalayim is the center of the halachic yishuv. Go 90 degrees east, 90 degrees west. After the 90 degree point, it's already a new day. Let's read, I have in the Maariv Makomos, I have some of the passages of the Nechmad Benayim of David Ganz inside. He points out the Siman Kuf Samach Aleph. You have it in your Maariv Makomos. First he has Siman Samach Dalet. For those who don't have a reading side. First, he points out, he calls Bitul Dasa Kadmonim B'Moshe Omu Shechatsi Kadir Ha'oret Shakua B'Mayim. They're wrong. And he says, not just that the Jews were wrong, everybody was wrong. He writes, Ba'afal Kisha Kola Kadmonim Hein Nibnei Yisroel Hein Ne'umas Ha'olam Kulam Choshu Shechatsi Kadir Ha'oret Megula. Right? In other words, there is land. V'chatzi sheni shakua v'tahua v'mayim. It's the first column, top line. Rosh Timsa l'chacham Ibn Ezra l'vadak zal perish ki hu al yomim yisada. That's how they interpret it when we say Mashir shal yom yom yishom. In other words, there is water that covers the whole, what we call today, the Western Hemisphere. And, of course, there's land on the east. Then he says, v'chein das ha-tochin ha-gadol rav Avram rav Chia b'altsura sa'aretz. And then also Rav Yisraeli, my name is Sefer Yisod HaOlam. Then he writes, then the Moreh Nevuchim also assumes this, even the Rambam assumed that, right? And then he says, well, what can we do? Kol HaKadmonim Kulam Ke'echem Nitzu B'Zeh Shom Gimu Mutayim Ki La'achronim Zemat Yosin and Me'yashonim. Still more than 100 years. Rav David Ganz is writing the early 1600s. Yosin Neyashana Vadhena Hine Yorde Hayom Ba'anias. This is working on Pesukim Tehillim here. Shluchei Tsarfas Usforad of Portugal. Hayordin Laturis Hayom Hisvade Lohem Vimare Velovachidos Shebechol Shisha Kvotzo Shalkadra Olo Motsu Diurim. Not only is there land, there are people on the land. Mehem b'yabosha, mehem b'diyei hayonim. Mehem b'chelek ha'elyon b'datenu, mehem b'chelek ha'tachdom. Hanoch ha'tachas kapos ragleinu. Right, that's another new discovery, which is not relevant to us, but is nonetheless fascinating. The Rishonim felt that there was only land on the northern hemisphere. When Prince Henry the Navigator from Portugal went around and discovered, you know, South Africa, went around the coast, he discovered that there is indeed land south of the equator also. Mehem b'chelek ha'elyon l'datenu, hem b'chelek ha'tachdon, hanochav tachas kapos ragleinu, v'hu ha'chelek ha'olam ha'chadash, the new world, shekorim nova munda. Right, it's a Hebrew of land of meaning new world. Asher Shom Yaboshor Chavas Yadayim. It's a very big continent. Who Chelik Gadol Korav Le Beishlishe Ha'olam Asher Nachkeshun Bahem. And then not only is there land, V'kulam Malein Son Adam. There are all these Indians there. In other words, you can't even try to defend the Khuzari and the Balamor and the other Shidduch by saying, okay, there's land, but there are only people in the eastern hemisphere, so therefore Eretz Yisrael is still, you know, that the inhabited land only goes east of Yerushalayim 90, and west of Yerushalayim 90. That's not correct either. There are people living in the western hemisphere. V'kulon Malayim Tzon Odom K'moshe Yisboyer B'samuch. And he goes on. So, Rav Tukhachinsky said the following. In other words, the position of the Khuzari works well with a view that you only take the 180 degrees of inhabited land. So Shlaim's in the middle, 90 degrees east, 90 degrees west. After you go 90 degrees east, it's no longer east, it's now west. But there are people, America, it's Mitzias, Umare Belom Lechidos. So, I don't have time to go through all the Shitas. Let me just tell you, the Chazon Ish, of course, in his Kuntres, Yudches, Charles, tried to work everything out, defending the Khuzari and defending the Balamor. He interpreted, there's a debate within Hadanasin, that he interpreted that the Rishonim themselves have this idea that you extend the landmass. That's a very big debate. For example, Chaim Zinman and other people had a view of the Khuzari that says it is indeed a line just going 90 degrees. So, and I heard that the Rav Moshe Soloveitcher, I heard, did not agree certainly with the position that the line is a Yam versus Yabosha land, line, coastline. That info is not correct. But in any event, even if you say the Yam Yabosh is not correct, you still have to say, is the line 90 degrees or is the line 180 degrees? So I have here from the Kuntres Yudches Shos of the Chazon Ish, I have Miftah Beis, the second of the letters of the Chazon Ish. Let's look at that briefly. So he has a great line in which he says, the discovery of America was lo male v'lo mori. Doesn't count. It's just not relevant. He said, okay. Hashkofa mamikul leherish hein shutis harishonim binin yudches shos lomar v'sheh shos midah v'shayim ha'nefshah of America's Vuseses al e yedia shel yeshub shedach kazer ha'tachto. That's not relevant. Smichto bez in the kunish one esrich shos kazish. The ein li yeshub ha'tachto shum yachas halacha ha'psuka shelohem. We are totally irrelevant. Lo yichus yuvi, lo yichus shlili. And then he makes the claim that this is also disputed. Yedias yeshub ha'tachton hi omnom demes. And of course, Chazal knew about it. Ki kvar v'nizkeres v'zohar ki yadur. So every single one of these statements is disputed. That's a very difficult passage in the Zohar Parshas Vayikra, which is passage in the Zohar, which according to Chazon Ish does hint that they knew the, whether this passage from Rav Shimon bar Yochai or not, we won't discuss now, but that it was known about the existence of America. But there's at least a three-way machlokes what that passage means. And Rav Tukhachinsky disputed the premise. He said it very well is dependent upon the assumption that there is only 180 degrees of inhabited land. So this is a machlokes that really is still in existence up until today. What do you do? Do you follow the Chazon Ish? Do you have the line either 90 or 90 plus? And therefore, what everyone in Japan is doing is wrong. The Japanese people think it's Sunday, it's really Friday, and therefore we should observe Sunday. Or do you follow Dr. Kaczynski? And I will tell you that in 1941, there was an asifa of Rabbonim in Yerushalayim, and including Rav Herzog, including Rav Isazam Meltzer, including Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, and they all disputed the Chazon Ish. Right? And my grandfather Shalom told me the point of the Asifa was, even though if maybe the Chazon Ish was greater than any other particular person here, but here all 19 Rabbanim felt Chazon Ish was not correct. And in fact, without even making a stand on the issue whether the line should be 180 degrees, as Rav Tukhachinsky said, or simply 114 degrees East Yerushalayim, you know, 149 degrees, like Yisod Olam had proved from the end of the Eastern Hemisphere, because if you look at a map, the eastern part of the Eastern Hemisphere, Kamchatka, is certainly to the east of Japan. So Japan, in any event, would be the far east. He said that the Rabbanim came to the conclusion that people have a right to observe Shabbos the day that the Japanese observe Shabbos. And this, of course, has ramifications on Yom Kippur. They have a right to fast on Yom Kippur the day that Yom Kippur is supposed to fall out. Yom Kippur falls out on a Wednesday. Chazon Ish said that year. Chazon Ish said, don't fast on Wednesday, fast on Thursday. They said, don't fast on Thursday, fast on Wednesday. So what are we going to do? So I spoke to numerous people. In fact, I spoke to one elderly person who was in Shanghai. I won't mention his name. So what he told me, I felt, was the way, at least to have a solution. He said that even though there were some people that were machmir like the Chazon Ish, there were a lot of people there that were only machmir for the Chazon Ish on the orisas. In other words, because essentially there are so many arguments against the Chazon Ish. Again, the Western Hemisphere exists. And as Rav Tukhachinsky said, it is not true that the position of the Kuzari and the Balamor is not relevant with respect to the discovery of America. It is relevant, because that was the whole premise, which is a mistaken premise. So, after consultation with my Rebbeim and the people, that's what we decided to do on the trip. So I said, Shabbos will be Shabbos. Sunday, in Japan, we will be Machmir for the Rishonim only, like the Chazon Ish. And the, how shall I say, to ascertain whether something is d'oraisa or d'rabbanan will be a, according to the consensus of poskim. Okay, there's not time today to discuss the issue of nolad kodem chatzos, Rabbi Yehuda Shneira kodem mishkiyah sachama, that of course is the raya of the Kuzari and the Balamor, but that's also a hotly disputed topic. Anyhow, so once we decided that, I now had the problem of implementing our halachic decisions. So I decided the first thing I have to do is to get a Sunday guy. What do I mean by that? Amir la'akum is a four-way machlokas we've shown about Amir la'akum. Rashi Avodah Zarah says from Dabar Davar, then it might be according to the Rambam a gzera. It might be a from Mechilta, which most of Shom say it's an asmachta. Lo sasikum locha. Mlacha should not be done. But according to all views, nobody says Amir la'akum is daraisa. Therefore, it's only rabbinic rule. As per what we did, we could tell a non-Jew to do Mlacha on Sunday. And that was certainly a great help in organizing the trip. So we were zocha to have a wonderful Sunday guide, Professor Lee. So the first thing he did was Saturday night to light the Havdalah candle. So he came in, he got his Zeppo lighter, and made a Bori Ma'orei Ha'esh. Then we had to decide what to do on Sunday morning. Now, here we had some new interesting problems, because we were considering going to a place which was going to be far outside Tokyo. And there's the problem of Tchumim. So now we have the big machlokas we've shown him, is Tchumim Doraisa or Tchumim Derabanan? So if Tchumim is Derabanan, that actually is the Ashkenazic position, there's no problem. However, there were three people in the group from Sephardic backgrounds. So now, there's actually a discussion in the Rambam's earlier position, the Rambam's later position, but the Rambam seems to have at least the idea that at least Tchumim of Yud Beis Mil is Doraisa. Right? That means, you look in Sefer Mitzvot, Simin Shin Chaf Aleph. There he certainly says that Tchumim is Asim in HaTorah. In Sefer Mitzvot, he even seems to imply that Tchumim of Yud Beis, of 2,000 Amos is in HaTorah. In Hilchos Shabbos, Perek Chav Zayin Halacha Aleph, he retreats from that extreme position and writes that only Tchumim Yud Beis Mil is min HaTorah. Now, the Ramban, Mizas Sogos, strongly disputes Rambam's view. And interesting, in the Ramban's Chidushim to Erevin, he even attacks the Rif. The Ramban never attacks the Rif, but here he seems to attack the Rif and Raivin for even suggesting such a view. So, this famous Ramban who says, I don't care that Yerushalmi might imply that Tchum is min HaTorah. We have a machlokes Bavli Yerushalmi. We go with the Bavli, and therefore all Tchum is Drabanan. Four Tchum is Drabanan, so on Sunday we could go to all four islands. But the problem is we had three Sfaradin, and I did not want to break the group up Milachat Chila. And indeed, the Beis Yosef follows Shitas HaRambam, and he concludes that Tchum of Yud Beis Mil is Doraisa. So we were very lucky because there was a problem with the bus. We ended up not going outside of Tokyo on Sunday. So that was lucky. But then we had a parallel problem. And this, of course, will be familiar to all of us, the question of Rishus HaRabim. Beis Yosef in Aruch Chaim Simin Shin Mem Hei presents the famous machlokas we've shown him regarding the definition of Rishus HaRabim. Rashi, Erevin Daf Vav, and Erevin Daf Nantes, Bali Atosos, the Smak, the Rush, Rosh Hashanah, the Tur. Indeed, the overwhelming consensus of Ashkenazic Rishonim maintained that one needs a congregation of 600,000 people to designate an area as Rishus HaRabim. Only if one carries in such an area would one violate Hotzah Min HaTorah. On the other hand, the Rambam, once again here the Rambam is the big machmir, Perek Yedal Hilchos Shabbos, the Ramban, the Rashba, the Ran, the Rivash, a whole host of Sephardic Rishonim, all maintain that an area is designated as Rishus HaRabim exclusively based upon the width of its boulevards, Tes Zayin Amo, and there's no requirement of 600,000 people passing through. So on Sunday, I ruled that the Ashkenazic students certainly can carry in any area not designated as Rishus HaRabim according to Rashi and the other authorities who follow Rashi's view. But again, our group contained those three aforementioned Sephardic students. So I couldn't tell them to go against the Beit Yosef. Then moreover, that large and noisy shopping district we were planning to go to on Sunday, although not as famous as a heavily populated Ginza district, right, the Shibuya, right, by all accounts, seemed to be at least a Suffolk Shishim Ribo. Parenthetically, let me add that the dispute between the late Moshe Feinstein, Zichron Levracha, and other authorities, whether one measures Shishin Ribo as a point through which the 600,000 people pass through, or as a box of 12 mil, right, pertains to the controversy about the Flatbush Eruv, etc., was very germane. So I thought here, at least in Japan, since we had Dr. Lee's service, as I will tell you in a minute, in any event, we could be machmer, ask for Rav Moshe, and get out of the problem. What do we do? He went to the district, but once again, Dr. Will Lee rode to the rescue. He carried all the wallets. He had a big knapsack. More than that. He had like 3-4 knapsacks. He said, students, give us your wallets. So he gave us his wallets, everything. In the entire duration of the time that we were in the area that was Safek Rishus HaRabim, he even carried the subway tickets outside the train station. Now, we went to the Japanese equivalent of Bloomingdale's. That was fine, because Mekach HaMemkar is only Asud Rabbanan. Mukza is only Asud Rabbanan. It was not choshes to the Ramban in terms of in Parshas Emor that say, but Lamaisa, there's no Los Asay Mudaraisa to violate Mukza. So I said you can handle Mukza on Sunday. What you are not allowed to do is to carry Mishun Panav Ofen. So we went inside the, I forgot the name, it was the equivalent of Bloomingdale's, a huge store. I bought a tie there, I was going to wear it, but I forgot. Only after we were safely inside the store did Dr. Lee give us back our wallets. And so since Mekach HaMemkar is no problem, Tilta Muksa is no problem, he bought some stuff. But there was one other problem I had to tell the people to be careful about. Those that pay with credit cards could not sign their ksiva. Okay, now here, of course, we have the we have the famous sheet of the Or Zerua that is very big. Actually, the debate between the Mishnah Berura and the Rav Avadia Yosef. Here, Rav Avadia Yosef actually is somewhat of a makel. When Mishnah Berura said there is one sheet that says that any other language besides Hebrew is not ksiva de araisa. So the Mishkan, of course, they wrote Hebrew letters on the crush. So Mishnah Berura throws that out. He said it's such a minority view, it can't even be used. Interesting, Rav Avadia Yosef says, you know, his Bikiyas, he says, you know, it's not just Or Zerua, a number of other Rishon from Ashkenaz quoted, it's not that out of the mainstream. Having said that, I said let's not rely on that shita. Now, here's what happened. So then we came back. Now, well, yes, I said kilacha. Yeah, they're actually, by the way, the Chai Adam has a chumra on kilacha yad that Chazish only has. That, you know, this kilacha yad in the form and kilacha yad in the result. So in other words, I don't think there was anyone in the group that was totally ambidextrous. In other words, some achronim say, if you have a kilacha yad that will produce the exact same result, if you, let's say, well, hotzah, there's no kilacha yad, because that, in terms of what you carry, what part of the body you carry your kusev also. But if you write equally efficiently with your right hand and your left hand, so the fact that you're, let's say, okay, I'm a lefty, so for me, my derech is my left hand. So just because I write my right hand, that per se might not make kilacha yad. You have to have a deficiency, not in the form of what you are doing, but in the effect. Okay, but hopefully I told them, don't write normally in when you sign your name. Okay. Now, very interesting. Dr. Lee, now we left the store. So Dr. Lee had these four or five huge knapsacks. He was carrying everything. Now, at one point, we got, I think, outside the subway. So we were in a relatively secluded area. He announced, he said, Ashkenazim, you may now retrieve your wallets. Svardim, I will hold on to them until we get to the actual courtyard of the hotel, which was the Azabu court. Now, you know, reflecting on our Shabbos Sunday experience, I thought of the Ramban, who in one of his beautiful passages in Sochas Yom HaShabbos, he writes that we fulfill this mitzvah every single day of the week. For example, today we said our Shir Shalom prayer, we were Makayim, Sochas Yom HaShabbos Wakacho. So in a unique way, our challenges on Sunday enhanced our kiyum of Zachar's Yom HaShabbos. I mean, we were Makayim, really, to when we had to figure out what is the Raisa, what is the Rabbanan, how to work everything out. And I think it helps us give a greater appreciation of Shabbos itself. when we are Mekayim not only Daraisa, but even Darabanans, and we have the additional directive of the Ramban on Shabbos itself, not to be Nevel B'Shus HaTorah on Shabbos. Indeed, the beautiful tefillos that the group had, we had a kumzitz on Friday night, and I think we demonstrated that even in Japan, one can not only make sure to fill the letter of halacha according to all the different shittos, but one can truly rise to the occasion and create a sublime religious experience in Shabbos anywhere in the world. Now, I'd like to move briefly to another issue, kashrus. In Kyoto, we face a very interesting dilemma. So there was no Chabad house, so if you wanted to eat anything besides the food that we personally brought from Tokyo or from the US, we found these 100% vegetarian Buddhist restaurants. By the way, no fish was served in these establishments either. Now, the Buddhists, from their point of view, are very makbid not to have any meat or animal product at all. Now, but the question was, how can we be sure that the Buddhist laws of 100% vegetarian did not contain any animal emulsifiers or other ingredients from non-kosher animals? In other words, we had to make sure that there was no problem with Hilchos Tarovdes either. Now, so my investigations led me to the conclusion, people told me, that according to Buddhist doctrine, one may not eat any admixture of animal product. Thus, according to their standards, even if a food contained a mixture of an animal product and vegetable product with a proportion less than 160, it would still be prohibited for a Buddhist to eat it. In fact, I think Dr. Lee told me, some Buddhists consider eating animals as reprehensible as cannibalism. Thus, if the food was prepared kedusha kedin, according to Buddhist law, we'll be fine. But there's another problem. How can we be sure that proprietors of the restaurants were not fooling everybody, including fooling the native Japanese Buddhists who took their dietary laws seriously? As we all know, people in food establishments, their goal is to make money. They will do, now they want to have a good business, but they want to make money, and if need to, they'll do what it takes. So how do we get out of that problem? So here, this of course pertains to the whole debate which happened over 20 years ago regarding tuna fish. So I relied upon the principle of Uma Memorah Cheskase, Shigmar Nechulim, Dav Samach Gimel, and in Yoridea Simen Pei Gimel, Zion, and I followed my Rebbe Rav Shechta's remarks in Aram Mizrach. It was actually just about 20 years ago. It's Teves Tavshin Mem Ches, which the issue of Uma Memorah Cheskase is sufficient, assuming there's no other problems, to claim that someone who claims that this product doesn't have any prohibited material is okay, the Kirvei Dagim. So I thought the following: the proprietors of the restaurant, they want to safeguard their reputation as a 100% vegetarian Buddhist restaurant. Not for us, but for all the Buddhists that go there. It was like right outside a temple. We have time to get to the temple issue in a minute. But they certainly want to maintain their reputation. Umla Morech Haskase. So even though non-Jews cannot be valid witnesses, la halacha, but there is a chazaka, based upon the principle of Ruba, the lesser Kaman, that it's in their best interest to tell the truth. So let me just point out, you know, when I got home, I realized that in Kyoto in 2007, we faced a situation comparable to that of our parents and grandparents' generation in the U.S., like in the 50s, before kashrus in America became more sophisticated. Now, once it became more sophisticated, of course, due to the principle of Mil Sadesh Levure Mavarino, and you have to check up as much as you have to check up, a kosher consumer in America today can no longer rely upon looking at the ingredients. You could only buy something with hashgacha. But my mother always tells me, in her days, one would simply carefully scan the ingredient label if it contained 100% pure vegetable shortening. It was fine. If it was not 100% pure implication, there was some animal shortening, it was out. So that's exactly what we basically did, because the 100% pure vegetable shortening, right, is the equivalent of the situation here in the restaurant. So that's a similar situation, Umalamara Cheskase in Kyoto.
I mean, at the end of the day, did we know for sure that the proprietors were not lying? Well, no one knows anything for sure. But as the Rambam tells us, we have the chazakos, and we live our lives according to seriously established halachos. So we got to the restaurant, we took our shoes off, there were no chairs, we sat down on our tatami mats, and we ordered. But there was another problem. Bishul akum. Now, although there was no problem with the various soy products and soups that were offered, rice, in my opinion, did pose a problem. And let me tell you why. According to the Gemara in Masechet Avodah Zarah, the Flamet Ches, any food that is classified as Eino Olel Shulchan Melachim, right, it's not, you know, high-class food, is not subsumed under the rubric of Bishul Akum. Now, Shulchan Aruch Yeridea, the customs of every country determine whether or not in that country a particular food is Olel Shulchan Melachim or not. Now, what I discovered is that in Japan, everybody eats rice, from the poorest peasant to Emperor Akihito. Now, if something is eaten also by the king, that's Olel Shulchan Melachim. The emperor might have fancy dishes in which he would eat the food, but his rice, the staple, remains the same. So I thought that we really, unless we somehow get out of the Bishul Akum problem for rice, I would not be comfortable in eating the rice product. So what do? We had this Japanese translator, and I had to somehow request the proprietors of the restaurant to, like, turn on the oven in which our hoped-for rice dishes would be prepared. So there were two restaurants in Kyoto. And one of them, I made it in time, and the other one, I didn't. So in one of them, we had some tasty rice dishes. But in the other one, we arrived too late, and the proprietors of the establishment did not want to start a new batch of rice just for us. So in the second restaurant, we had to rely on 25 different types of soy dishes. But thankfully, in my view, they were very tasty. Finally, I'd like to discuss a third issue that we dealt with, one that turns out had very profound religious repercussions for our status as Jews. You know, the Rav once said something along the lines that there's like a 14th ikar that a Jew should be a proud Jew, you know, in any society, the most technologically advanced, scientifically advanced society anywhere in the world. And that applies to Japan also, as we will see. So let's talk briefly about Buddhism and the issue of the temples. Now, it may come to a surprise to many of us here that many historians and philosophers of religion do not classify Buddhism as a polytheistic religion. This is in contradiction to the Shinto faith, which is generally recognized to assume the existence of thousands upon thousands of deities. I heard one figure of 40,000. Now, who is the Buddha? The Buddha himself was a man who had attained enlightenment. He just understood. It's like analogous to our Midrashic Kabbalistic notions about Chanoch from the beginning of Sefer Bereishis, or perhaps Eliyahu. But technically, Buddha is not a god. The original Buddhism, they didn't get into these issues of cosmology, cosmogony. It was just simply you attain enlightenment, you understand what is. Now, if you look at that prat, then technically a Buddhist temple, which is the temple of Buddha, is not a, let's be very careful here, it's not technically a place of avoda zara to a foreign god. But nonetheless, it's still avoda zara. It's foreign worship. They have with the incense, and you take your shoes off, and you have all those statues and everything, so it's still foreign worship. So it's at the end of the day, even if you don't classify Buddhism as polytheism, I thought it's still usher to go inside those temples. And Lanius Daiti, I think there's a second problem. The second problem is Maris Ayin. How many average Jews know this distinction that the philosophers of religion say when they say Buddhism is not technically Avodah Zarah? I heard over the years many cases from Rabbi Beryl Weinman. Whenever he talks about Avodah Zarah, he talks about the Buddhists and the eight arms and the heavy God. So everyone thinks that Buddhism is Avodah Zarah in the technical sense of polytheism. So good. So it's not polytheism. It's Avodah Zarah, not to another deity. But people don't realize that. So it's certainly Maris Ayin of Avodah Zarah to a foreign god. Besides the point that there still is worship to this Buddha. The Amcha of Buddhists certainly, over the course of time, began to pray to Buddha to help them achieve their goals in life. And the temples of the prayers are such prayers. Now this notion violates the fifth of the 13 Ikarim of the Rambam, that a temple thus designated is a place where people are going, praying to Buddha to help them achieve their goals in life. So even if Buddha is not a god, it's certainly Avodah Zarah. Now, then we had to set, so I feel we just cannot enter these temples. What about those gardens? Outside the temples, there are these beautiful Japanese gardens which are owned by the Buddhists. It's part of their territory, even though the gardens are not part of the temples. So here, I thought it's not a temple. I thought there was room to be Meikil. But there was one other problem I had to take care of. The Rambam Sefer Mitzvos, Losa Seyud Gimel, rules that a Jew may not plant a tree in the base of Mikdash near the Mizbeach, for such planting was an act practiced by the Kananim. In other words, Asherah. So I had to make sure there was no Netiyah Lishma L'shem Asherah by the Buddhists. So, you know, there was some experts there on Buddhism. I found out basically that it certainly belongs to the Buddhists, but they were not planting the trees l'shem Buddhism. So there was no netiyah l'shma. So therefore, I decided I would be committed to stroll through the gardens as long as, one, the gardens were not clearly part of the Buddhist temple precincts per se, and two, as I just mentioned, there's no netiyah l'shma regarding the various flowers and plants. Again, if the gardens were planted for purposes of worship of the Buddha, I thought in any event it would constitute an asherah, and one who walks there would be deriving pleasure from an asherah. But there was no evidence for that. Now, when I was an undergraduate, we read this, this book from Arthur Lovejoy, Essays in the History of Ideas. And one of the essays was called On the Origin of a Chinese Romanticism. He talks about the British gardens. You know, there are two types of gardens. There are these very, very neat, straight gardens, and then these very wild, expansive, expressive gardens. So I read it when I was in Shiva College over 25 years ago. So when I read it, I never thought it actually would be in a Japanese garden in Japan. But I can tell you, it was very, very pleasant. But all this leads us to probably what was the one confrontation we had in our trip. Now, halacha is full of borderline cases. And as the Rav always pointed out, so much of halacha is a question of amos, tfachim, handbreadths, 40 saw. And the Rav said, when you reach the boundary line, you must submit to the will of the Almighty. So in Japan, we faced such a borderline case. And I think this case demonstrated the chasm that exists between halachic Jews and others, even if they mean well, but just do not understand the halachic way of thinking. Here was the case. The issue concerned whether we could pass through a Buddhist temple, you know, like Kapandaria, run through, in order to get to a garden which was situated on the other side. Apparently, there was no other way to get to this magnificent garden. So I decided we just simply cannot do so. Because someone who enters a Buddhist temple, even if it's, you know, Kapandari, just passing through, he has to take his shoes off for the purification ceremony. So forget it. That, again, this is, again, even if Buddha is not a god, it is still Avodah Zarah, it's foreign worship, and once you have to get inside and take your shoes off, it's tantamount to performing an act of Avodah Zarah. So I thought we couldn't even pass through the temple to reach the veranda on the other side. So this caused a certain amount of tension between the group and a professor from another university who accompanied us on our Japanese journey. And this woman, a recognized expert in the field of Japanese art history, who taught us a lot about that, and possessed a positive attitude towards Jews, simply could not understand the boundary lines we erected. Of course, we should always remember The fact that others do not understand our way of life does not release us at all from our obligations that we have throughout our lives to maintain our halachic traditions. Let me conclude with the following. Japanese have a tradition of a travel diary in which, over the course of an excursion, one learns some deep and profound truth about oneself. So in this vein, I'd like to say the following. We're all aware in Judaism of the tension between particularism and universalism. Rav Tzchon Bracha discussed this, Ger v'toshav. On the one hand, we are part of the human community. We follow many of the ideas of science. We participate in the science, technology, all the areas of endeavor of the world, but we have our concerns of our own. So when I agreed to serve on this trip, I thought that this would reinforce my view that, you know, since I'm going to see the universalist aspect, I'm going to show that to one extent we are citizens of the world. Then I would go back to the YU and, you know, have my particularistic side giving my share. So I thought the trip would fortify these feelings. I thought the trip would say, yes, we understand, everyone's created some Elohim, and yes, we see the Japanese people, and indeed, by the way, I did learn a lot. We saw a beautiful museum in which survivors of Hiroshima had murals of all the tragedies in the world, and they also had a mural about the Holocaust. And I thought that was very impressive, that they got beyond their own pain, and they realized that all human beings suffer, and that's something to think about when one hears these remarks like, oh, Goyim don't care about the suffering of the Jews. Here, we saw it with our own eyes. But besides that lesson of my universalistic side, Hashem works in mysterious ways. And after the confrontation about the garden, I realized that on Adarabba, I was in the midst of learning another lesson, that dafka my particularistic side, like the side that tries to mekayim, what the Rav said, that we must rot our lives, keep every iota of halacha, no matter where we are, in what situation, that was being emphasized. My identification as a frum Jew who can proudly wear the badge of frumkeit anywhere in the world. You know, when I saw the, you know, the students, we had that great kumsitz Friday night, and the singing and the davening, I realized that Baruch Hashem, this trip really was, in the deepest sense, a Kiddush Hashem, in which we demonstrated that we can mekayim halacha anywhere in the world. Thank you very much.